supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Insect that has the potential to knock back the stink bugs that are driving us crazy in the mid-Atlantic and northern states. You won't want to miss it. And you won't, but we're going to start with some of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Richard, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Why, thank you. Hello, Mike.
Hello, Richard. How are you, man?
I'm fine, and I thank you, and I appreciate you taking the time to take my call.
Well, thank you for taking the time to make it, sir. Where are you?
I'm in Lafayette Hill, a suburb of Philadelphia.
I know Lafayette Hill. It used to be the home of WIBG, one of the original rock and roll top 40 radio stations in Philadelphia.
That's the spot. I have a question regarding my fig trees, and I'm sure it's something that a bunch of people might appreciate. As I'm getting too old to properly handle them, and I need to know what would be the minimum that I need to do to protect them for over the winter.
What did you do this past winter? Which
I've been doing for the 5 years that I've raised them from cuttings, I have wrapped them in cotton sheet, first tying them with twine to compress them,
right.
Wrapping them with sheet material, then carpeting or insulation material, and then tar paper on the exterior of that.
This is very Italian, Richard.
Italian gentleman who gave me the cuttings, and from what he told me, the trees actually came from Italy as cuttings, and they can be traced back of 125 years.
Probably as can he. Yeah, and that that recipe for wrapping is pure Italian poetry. That's like a hand-me-down ravioli recipe.
Mm.
So your trees have been very comfy during the winter.
Yes.
Yeah. Now, have you unwrapped them for the season?
Not as yet. I'm going to do that tomorrow.
Because one of the things that we're going to be looking for is, if you go to that much trouble, Rich, do your figs suffer any winter injury while they're out there?
None.
Yeah, see, that's what I'm thinking. Figs are a Mediterranean plant. Our winters here in Pennsylvania and anywhere north of here can be very rough on them, with the exception of areas in Center City, Philadelphia itself, where the heat sink protects the trees. I can tell you, and you know, Lafayette Hill, how far are you from Center City? 12 miles? 15?
About 15 miles, but my trees are planted 8 feet off of the rear wall of my garage, and that rear wall faces to the southeast.
Okay, good. So it absorbs some heat and protects the trees a little bit.
A little bit.
Yeah. But I was going to say, in Center City, you wouldn't have to do anything, man.
Really?
In South Philly, they don't wrap their trees over the winter. Now, the less you do, the more winter injury the top of the tree and the outlying areas of the tree will suffer. But the trees will not die. You know, we call them semi-hardy, but in truth, their guts, their hearts are extremely hardy because they can die back to the ground.
I didn't know that. And
that ground root will regrow. The difference is if you lose more than half the tree in a really savage winter and the tree's not protected, you won't get any figs or you get very few figs. I bet you're getting gobs of figs off these trees.
That's true. Now, are we primarily trying to protect the tree from freezing or from wind damage, drying out?
Very smart, man. Wind damage is the big killer in the winter time of a lot of these trees. But their outermost portions are going to freeze. They don't handle ice and heavy snow very well. I would say that in a typical winter, your technique of bundling up the trees with cotton sheets would be enough to keep them alive with some small amount of damage that you would have to prune away in the spring. So I think you could leave several ingredients out of your recipe. The cotton sheets are, in one part, the most important part here, because they are shielding the tree, but they're also breathing. Should we get a hot winter or a winter where we get one of these summer weeks right in the middle? Trees that are wrapped up too much, and people who make the fatal mistake of using sheets of plastic, they get cooked underneath there. So really, you are preparing for the unpreparable. But I would say if you want to cut back to the minimum, do a double layer of cotton sheets.
And, that's good news.
And you might, you know, in a really bad winter, you're going to suffer some serious knockback. But looking at the winters we've had over the past 10 years, 8 years out of 10, those trees are going to come out of that looking real good.
Oh, that's very good news. I just really can't handle the heavy carpeting any longer.
Oh, yeah, no, it must be a bear to be up on an orchard ladder and trying to throw carpet over a tree.
Yes, what's your feeling about the tar paper?
No, I think you're fine. I think the sheets are all you need.
Oh, great.
All right?
Mike, I appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
All right, Richard, good luck and happy fig eating.
And I'll continue listening to your good advice on the radio.
Thank you, sir.
Bye-bye now.
1-888-346-9499. Joe, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello there, Mike. How are you today?
I am doing very well, Joe. How are you?
Well, I'm doing pretty good today.
And where is Joe doing well?
In the mountains in southwest Virginia, a little town called Gate City.
Okay, very good. What can we do for you?
We have a property that's kind of at the base of, or on the slope of a ridge. And right at the end of our property line, we had this great big willow tree. My parents have lived on the property over 40 years, and the tree was mature when they came. Last fall, one big limb fell off, and last week, the tree just split down the middle and broke in half. And it's not salvageable. So I'm wondering what we could plant there that we have no other shade trees in the front yard, something that would grow pretty quickly and provide a nice canopy in the summertime.
You face the ultimate problem of mm-hmm. all gardeners. The faster the growing tree, the weaker it is structurally, and the sooner it will develop its own problems and begin splitting and dropping branches. The faster the growth, the weaker the tree. That is a firm rule. Shade trees are kind of planted for the future. Now, there's a couple of other issues here. Are we taking the roots out of the ground?
Well, I think we're going to have to. I mean, it takes up a considerable space. Well, I don't know whether this could be pulled because it's so rotted. I didn't realize the tree was so as sick as it evidently has been for several years.
Let's not say it was sick. I mean, everything has a lifespan. It may have, from what you're describing, if it was like this magnificent ancient tree, it might have died of natural death from old age. Now, one thing about willows, however, is willows are often planted in a very wet spot because mm-hmm. people believe that they'll soak up excess water, and of course that can't happen, but they don't die in a wet spot, which is a big advantage. Do we have any reason to believe that this is an area that drains poorly, or is there a large water source right nearby?
No, actually, it's on a slope.
You said it's a weeping willow, and it got very large.
Yes.
It found water somewhere, honey.
Well, I'm sure that there was, you know, water that was there. I mean, it would maybe drain there and then eventually move on, but it was in kind of a flat place, and then the ground keeps sloping. You know, we're just kind of in a hilly area, so
it may
there's
have
not
actually,
a lot of flat it land, be, actually.
It may have actually been planted there to stabilize that ridge because people knew that the roots would go out and really lock themselves down. It's going to be expensive to get the stump pulled. I would urge you to consider another willow. I can't think of a tree that would grow faster for you. I would think a willow or a maple. And once you get right down to it, the question of getting a large tree quickly is simply buying a larger tree in the beginning. When you go to a nursery, mostly people are buying 2 or 3 year old trees, but you can buy 6, 7, 8 year old trees that are probably going to need to be professionally installed. But obviously, they'll hit the ground running and they will develop that canopy much faster. Beware of anything you see in a magazine ad or at the nursery that says grow 6 or 8 feet a year, because they just fall apart after 5 or 10 years.
Okay. I appreciate your input.
All right, Joe. Good luck, and we're sorry about your willow.
Thank you so much for your help.
All right. Good luck.
Bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and check on my first run of tomato and pepper starts. They are right under 4 long, bright, fluorescent lights, growing up tall and stocky. And it's just about time to give them their first feeding. A nice top dressing of worm castings to help them grow up big and strong. But don't you go recycling your red wiggler waste into tasty red fruit just yet, because we'll be right back with more of your fabulous phone calls and how to get those Colorado potato beetles out of your potato patch. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden.
You Bet Your Garden is made possible with support from Seed Savers Exchange, whose 2011 Heirloom Seed Catalog, offering nearly 600 varieties, is now available. Learn more at seedsavers.org.
You're listening to WHYY-FM. It's toad migration season in Roxborough. Thousands of Philadelphia toads return to where they were born to mate, but many are killed as they cross the road by cars. For the past 3 years, volunteers have helped protect the toads by closing the roads on nights when toads are out in large numbers. You can find out more and see photos at newsworks.org, WHYY's online home for news.
The Salvation Army proudly supports WHYY. While some people's legacies are engraved on monuments, yours can be written on the lives of others. Whether it's through your will, a charitable gift annuity, or other plan giving options, your assets can continue to help your family and your community. And the Salvation Army can help. The Salvation Army Legacy Planning, 800-213-1618. That's 800-213-1618, or www.salvationarmyphiladelphia.org.
The WHYY forecast, sunny with a high around 43 degrees this afternoon. Tonight, partly cloudy with a low near 27. Tomorrow, cloudy in the morning, but clearing up in the afternoon, high around 44 degrees. Monday, mostly sunny with a high around 46. And Tuesday, partly cloudy with a high near 52 degrees. It's 35 degrees in Center City at 1119. This is WHYY.
Supporting WHYY Backyard Farmers, offering organic products to turn your backyard into a family food producing experience. From vegetable gardens to hen houses to rainwater harvesting systems. More at backyardfarmers.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, a multitude of ways to protect your spuds from the dreaded Colorado potato beetle, and lots more of your fabulous phone calls. But right now, it is my privilege to welcome our very special guest, Dr. Kim Holmner from the Beneficial Insect Research Unit of the ARS USDA Lab in Newark, Delaware, the man working on our stink bug problem. Dr. Holmner, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Well, thank you, Mike.
It is a true pleasure to have you here, sir.
Well, I'm glad to be on, and I hope I can give you some interesting information.
Well, I am a huge fan of beneficial insects and research in general. And one of the things I always tell people whenever we have one of these imported pests that shows up and gets out of control, one of the ways that we as a nation react to that is the USDA typically sends researchers over to the pest's homeland to watch what eats it there, and then they try to figure out what predator or parasite they can safely bring over here. And is that what happened with this new stink bug that's causing so much trouble in our country?
That's right. As soon as the stink bug became obvious as a pest in eastern Pennsylvania a few years ago, and it was identified as an Asian invader. We started to do research on it, and we recognized that it had a potential of developing into an important economic pest of various crops in the U.S. based on what we knew it fed on in Asia. So at that point, we initiated some background research to find out what sort of natural enemies attack it in Asia and what kind of impact they have. At the same time, we began to look at native natural enemies here in North America to see whether they would step in and do the job.
What is it about, because we have native stink bugs, right? We've always had stink bugs.
That's right, yeah, quite a few different species.
So why did this, is it the marmalated stink bug?
Brown marmalated stink bug, yeah. Fancy word basically meaning marbled.
And our stink bugs are no pleasure. And for the first couple of years, this bug was around because, as you and I discussed earlier, I live in Ground Zero. I live in the county in Pennsylvania where this bug was first discovered. Mostly, it was an annoyance coming into people's houses to hibernate in the wintertime. And I have to give you guys all the credit and all the chops in the world because the very first articles I saw about it said that this was a hideous fruit pest crop in, I believe, Korea, and that was the potential for danger over here, but we didn't see it, and then last summer, it wreaked havoc in northeastern gardens.
That's right. It's not uncommon for invasive insects to take a few years for their populations to build to the point where their true impact becomes evident, and we think that's probably what happened with the brown marmorated. Clearly, it had been present here for a number of years, and populations very, very gradually grew. And in recent years, they've been growing faster and faster because there are more and more of them.
Now, when we talk about beneficial insects and natural predators, everybody knows the ladybug. I don't think enough of them know that it's the larval form of the ladybug that really chows down on aphids and other soft-bodied pests. One of my favorites is the lacewing family, whose very similar-looking larvae are so notorious. Isn't one lacewing known as the aphid lion?
That's right, yeah. The immature lacewings are very important predators.
And another of my favorites is the broad family of what we call mini-wasps, who parasitize caterpillars. And every tomato grower in America, I don't think any of us have ever seen the wasps, they're so small. But we've all seen the after effects on a tomato hornworm when they have those white spines down their back.
That's right, and this is exactly the kind of natural enemy that we're looking at as a predator or a natural enemy of the brown marmorated stink bug. We're looking at parasitic wasps that specialize in attacking the eggs of the stink bugs.
Now, we want to make clear to our listeners, because you say wasp and people start freaking out because they've been stung by paper wasps and hornets and mud dauber wasps. These things are almost impossibly tiny, right?
That's right. Most people are well aware of the big wasps that sting, but most wasps actually are these parasitic types of wasps. Nearly every insect has a natural enemy that is a parasitic wasp of some type, and usually they're so small that we do not even see them. Almost every insect in our environment here has parasitic wasps that attack it, and they're around us in the environment everywhere all the time, and most people don't even know it. So we're not talking about something that is unusual or rare.
No, and literally the line on these things, which I believe is true, is they are typically the size of a period at the end of a sentence in a newspaper story.
Yeah, many of them are extremely small, and with the wasps that we're looking at, which attack the stink bug eggs, a stink bug egg, of course, is very tiny, maybe a 25th of an inch or so in size, and the wasps are just as tiny, very, very small, and if you weren't looking for them deliberately, you would not even notice that they were around.
An expert like you can look at a cluster of eggs and tell which ones have been attacked.
It's pretty easy within a day or two of the attack of the wasp. The wasp, the female wasp, wanders around the leaves looking for the stink bug eggs. And when they find a mass, the female will lay her own egg inside the stink bug egg. And within the space of a few hours, that egg hatches and a small wasp begins to grow. And as that wasp offspring gets larger and larger, it consumes the stink bug egg from the inside. And in the end, it will produce another wasp rather than a healthy young stink bug.
People who had these things all over the tomatoes last summer are now standing up and cheering at their at their radios, Dr. Holmer.
A lot of people are eager to find some justice applied toward the stink bug.
Now, in the north, you're in Newark, Delaware. That's where the ARS Beneficial Insect Lab is. That's where you work out of. In our mid-Atlantic region, off the wall, ballpark guess, how many native mini-wasp species would you say that we have in our farms and gardens?
Well, the number is in the hundreds of thousands, I'm sure.
That's amazing.
For any insect you can imagine a parasitic wasp that will attack that specific insect.
So these beneficials, by definition, by the way they live, their entire culture, makes them one of the safest insects to release.
That's right. One of the reasons that we are so focused on parasitic wasps as biological control agents is that they typically are very focused on finding and developing in a very specific groups of insects. The wasps that we're working with for the brown marmorated stink bug we know will only attack stink bug eggs. This is in contrast with a predator, which will feed on, in many cases, anything it can catch.
Right, typically like a praying mantis or spider, which some people consider beneficial, but you have to point out that they'll eat anything, including good bugs.
That's right, and because they're not very focused on a specific type of insect, their impact on any given pest is oftentimes rather low.
Now, I know the typical procedure at this point is you're being careful not to let any of these wasps out into the environment. When do you think you'll begin any kind of release in the outdoors?
The kind of research that we need to do in order to demonstrate that these wasps are safe enough and specific enough to release typically takes several years to conduct under quarantine laboratory conditions. All of our studies must be done in a containment laboratory until we receive permission to release an exotic species. So we've already begun this work. We're about a year into it, and we think that if we can find an agent that we believe is safe enough to release, this could happen within perhaps 2 years of laboratory work.
Because you got people on the edge of their seats, Doc.
I know everybody would like to see it sooner.
They're dying to let Rocky into the ring to get some revenge here. I am so thrilled that we have found something that attacks these stink bugs. I'm sorry we got to wait a couple of more years, but we are looking forward to this research being released into the environment and give these pests a little something to take home with them.
Well, we're very hopeful as well, and we're looking forward to the date when we can release these and put them to work.
All right. Well, we're going to follow your research very carefully, and we'll be happy to tell our listeners when the bugs are in the air. Dr. Kim Holmner from the Beneficial Insect Lab at the ARS-USDA Research Center in Newark, Delaware, working on a way to keep the stink bugs under control. Dr. Holmer, thank you for being on the show, and thank you for your good work, sir.
Thank you very much, Mike. My pleasure.
And I want to mention to our listeners that even though our interview with Dr. Holmer will be edited, we're going to put the entire unedited interview, featuring a couple of things we cut for time, up on our website, youbetyourgarden.org, so you can hear every word that he and I said during the interview. And now back to your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Carlos, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. Great program.
Why, thank you, sir. Where are you?
Well, I'm a couple of clicks out of Springfield, Ohio.
Very good.
Home of the Buckeyes.
Excellent, excellent. What can we do for Carlos near Springfield?
Well, that's actually Carlos, but that's all right, Mike.
Now, what am I getting wrong here, sir?
It's Carlos.
Carlos, like right. Somebody who doesn't have wheels to drive around in.
Yeah, K-A-R-L-I-S.
Okay, and what's the derivation of that name?
I'm from Latvia originally.
Oh, okay. Very good. All right. Carlos, what can we do for you?
Well, my question is about potatoes.
Okay.
I have some Yukon Golds left over from last year in the basement. Small ones that we didn't get around to, and they've got big sprouts on them.
Right.
If I were to plant those, can I expect a crop?
So, where did you get your seed potatoes that you grew in your garden last year?
They came from, well, you're probably not familiar with Landmark, but it's one of our agricultural outlet stores here in the vicinity.
Okay, good. So you went to a garden center and you bought certified virus-free potatoes and you planted them. And you got a good harvest, I'm taking it?
Yeah. Well, I put out about 2 rows, about 70 foot, and that's more potatoes than we can use.
And did you see any signs of disease on your potatoes?
I don't think so, Mike.
Okay. Two things going on here. Obviously, the official advice is I should tell people to only plant brand new certified virus-free potatoes. But you're in a unique situation, but these were certified virus-free. That's the only kind you could have bought for your planting stock, and you grew them in your own garden. And it's perfectly legit to save seed from year to year. The question as to whether these potatoes will produce for you is a variable one. Obviously, you would do better if the potatoes had eyes on them only, or sprouts that were maybe an inch long. I'm guessing we have the weird tendrils coming out like a foot long that I get on some of my potatoes.
Well, you're right there, Mike. Some of them do have the real long tendrils. And I just wondered if I could cut those off and just kind of rely on that little fuzziness that's down, the little sprouty things that's down close to the potatoes itself. I've never done this before, so...
That's what all the girls say, Carlos.
Yeah, you're right.
You're into what I consider some of the most fun of gardening. All your ideas are sound. The answer is truly nobody knows until you try it. All potatoes are different. If I were to hazard what's going on here, it has to do with how much energy is left in the tuber itself. If the tuber is all shrunken up and there doesn't appear to be any potato meat left inside, then there's really not a lot of seed to grow for you. If the potato still has some integrity and the only thing that has happened over time is the starches have turned to sugars, then yes, trimming them back to a couple of inches and planting them, you got a good chance of getting a crop off them. But the best part is there's no way to tell until you try it. And if you've got, let's say, 50 potatoes and 20 of them are just, there's nothing left once you take the eyes off. It's just all a wrinkly mess. Don't bother with those. But if you have like 20 potatoes that are still good and sound, they just have these long tendrils coming out of them, I love your idea of cutting them down to like 2 inches long. Don't go any lower than that. And putting them in the ground. And, you know, as soon as you can work your soil, as soon as it's dry enough, you can put potatoes in the ground. They're pretty cold hardy plants.
Yeah, well, the garden right now, we've had a lot of rain here, so it'll be a while before I can plant anything. But what I'm going to do, along with trying this replanting, is I'll buy some more seed potatoes and go ahead and start another row with those. So
I think
I'm assured of a crop.
I think that's a great idea. And what I'm going to ask is that at the end of the season, you call us back and tell us how the overwintered potatoes did. Because in truth, all of the potatoes we buy as seed potatoes were harvested last year and simply stored a little more professionally to kind of prevent this loss of energy. I think they're stored very cold. Sometimes they're stored in like dirt or media at like 40 degrees to kind of just slow down the life processes so that when we're ready to plant, we bring them out. And ideally, there might not even be any eyes. They might just be whole potatoes that have survived the winter well. And then you'd sit them in the sun for a couple of days until they started to sprout, and then you'd plant them.
I don't do the sun thing, but I do generally try to buy the ones that had the most eyes and then recut them and then plant them that way. And I've had real good luck with Yukons, and we like the taste of the potatoes, so that's basically what I plant.
They're the best tasting potato out there, hands down. And like I said, just don't plant anything where there's nothing left. But any potatoes you got that still look like potatoes, I think you should give them a chance to grow.
Well, thanks a lot, Mike. I will give you a call back and see how this thing turned out.
Yeah, we'll all be curious. All right. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Mike.
Bye-bye. Well, it's time for me to take a little break and warn all the cats and kittens who listen to our show out of Salisbury, Maryland, that I will appear nearby at the Ocean Pines Community Home Show on Saturday, April 30th at the Community Center in Ocean Pines, Maryland. But don't you go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with how to stop the Colorado potato beetle, the new weapon in the war against stink bugs, and lots more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden.
You Bet Your Garden is made possible with support from Seed Savers Exchange, whose 2011 Heirloom Seed Catalog, offering nearly 600 varieties, is now available. Learn more at seedsavers.org.
Mike McGrath, right back at you with local events. Next Saturday, April 2nd, I'll deliver two talks at the Green Gardening Workshop and Native Plant Sale at the Lower Macungie Community Center in the beautiful Lehigh Valley. I'll help you get your lawn off drugs at 10 a.m. and reveal the 7 secrets of successful organic gardeners at noon. That's next Saturday in magnificent Macungie. Then on Saturday, April 9th, I'll green up your landscape at 1:30 at the Delaware County Environmental Fair in Wallingford, PA. An all-day environmental event where you can also see and maybe drive the super cool Tesla all-electric sports car. We'll post all the details at the events section of our website, youbetyourgarden.org.
You're listening to WHYY-FM. The WHYY forecast, sunny with a high around 43 degrees this afternoon. Tonight, partly cloudy with a low around 27. And tomorrow, a mix of sun and clouds with a high near 44. It's 33 degrees in Bryn Mawr and 36 degrees in Center City, Philadelphia at 11:39.
Supporting WHYY, Morris Arboretum celebrates Japanese Cherry Blossom Festival. Two Saturdays, April 2nd and 9th, with Japanese drummers, swordsmanship, a traditional tea ceremony, and more. Details at morrisarboretum.org.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we'll be getting to the question of the week. Potatoes are one of my favorite things to grow. You've never really tasted a potato till you've pulled a fresh and juicy one right out of the ground, washed it off, and eaten it there right in the garden. But the Colorado potato beetle wants to make sure you never experience that. So we will tell you how to beat the beetle after a couple more of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Steve, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
How you doing, Mike?
I'm doing good, Steve. How are you doing?
I'm doing outstanding. I'm in Laurel Springs, New Jersey, about 12 miles east of beautiful downtown Camden.
Okay, very good. What can we do for Steve in the Garden State?
Well, I'm having problems with my pine trees. Some of them are white pine, and some of them are native pine trees. With the native trees, I got thousands of these little holes on them up and down the tree. And on the white pine, I have quarter-inch holes that seem to wrap around the tree.
In a perfect circle.
Yes.
Yeah.
What am I up against?
Perhaps nothing. what is the health of the trees like in general? How do they look? How are the needles? What's the color like?
Well, on a couple of them, I lost the trees. The needles browned out, and that's what the ones with the holes all over them, the very small holes, I guess they're about a 16th of an inch.
Hmm. And are these trees fed, mulched?
No, they're just as they were in their native habitat.
And the trees that died, did you have them removed?
Yes.
And did anybody examine them for bark beetles?
No.
There are a lot of existing pests that attack wood. There are a lot of imported pests that are relatively new on the scene and are doing a tremendous amount of damage. Sometimes when you see these holes, especially in a complete circle, it means woodpeckers have been working away at your tree. So the trees that you have now, I would have them examined. I would try to get your local extension agent over to take a look at these holes. He or she are the best person to tell you if this is a borer or a bark-eating beetle or something else. But I tell you, when these imported pests strike a tree, so far there's no defense. There's very little that can be done. My general advice is to lure woodpeckers and other meat-eating birds to the trees over the winter with suet. Now, okay, we're kind of getting out of that time of year, but to make a quick run and to hang a suet feeder from each tree, even for just a week or two before the weather gets really hot, you have a chance to attract chickadees and nutthatches, the titmouse, wrens, woodpeckers. All of these birds are tremendously adapted to attacking these bark-eating pests. But if you have not been feeding the trees, if you have not been mulching the trees, if they're in a fairly normal environment, there isn't much you can do. It doesn't sound like you've made any mistakes.
Okay.
You know, typically when this happens, people have been pounding those chemical tree spikes into the ground, or they got them mulched with chipped up pallets spray painted orange. But if your trees are in a natural setting, birds are your best help. If you want to try to do something to strengthen the tree, it would not be bad at all to spread some compost around their base, no more than an inch thick, and not touching the base. That way, every time it rains, the trees will get a gentle, natural feeding. But try to attract meat-eating birds. All birds eat meat at this time of year. Like I said, 2 weeks of suet feeders could bring them in. Then keep a bird bath out there near the trees. Keep it filled with water. And I would call my local extension office. You know, that New Jersey has a great county extension system. And see if they'll come out, because the fact that some of your trees have died, I fear you do have an infestation of a bark-eating pest. And some of these creatures, I won't lie to you, Steve, are just stone nasty. They're killing trees all over the country.
Yes. Will BT help any?
Only if it's a caterpillar pest. If it's a beetle, it won't have any effect on them at all.
I see.
What would work, if you can get it in the hole, would be to squirt in beneficial nematodes, which are microscopic creatures that would attack anything.
Okay.
In there. And you can actually buy a little syringe, a little garden syringe, and you mix the nematodes, the beneficial nematodes, with water, and you actually inject them into the tree. It is super cool.
All right, sounds great. I'm going to rent me some woodpeckers.
Yeah. Good luck, Steve. I hope it's not one of these Asian wood-boring beetles, but if it is, put up a good fight, man.
Will do. Thank you very much. I really enjoy your show.
All right. Good luck, sir.
Take care.
1-888-346-9499. Elizabeth, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, Elizabeth. How are you?
I'm very well.
And where is Elizabeth very well?
Bethlehem, Pennsylvania.
Very good. I know it well. What can we do you for?
I have raspberry bushes. When is the best time to prune them? My father is coming around with pruning shears over the winter, and I I started listening to your show last year, and I thought I recalled you saying it wasn't prudent to prune when it's cold out.
Oh, no, no, that's not true. Many plants that need major pruning work, it should be done during the dormant season, especially like large trees. That's the best time to prune them. But I will also say, anytime a man approaches your plants with pruners in his hand, you should distract him. Pull out bright and shiny objects, offer him a drink, get him out of there, because no good will...
Yeah, I hid the shears. That's worked so far.
Yeah, always hide the shears from helpful men. That's a firm rule of gardening. Now, there are two types of raspberry. Some raspberry varieties only fruit once during their lives. But the canes of most varieties, including the most common varieties like Heritage, which is the most planted raspberry variety, will fruit twice on the same cane. So until you get their life cycle down, much better not to prune at all than to prune in error. Raspberries do not need pruning to produce fruit. They don't need that stimulation. The only pruning that's done is when the cane is truly dead. How long have you had your raspberry canes in the ground?
2, possibly 3 years last year, and they do produce fruit twice a year.
Okay, yeah, so see, that's why you don't want to be pruning them. What happens in the spring, very soon in the spring, your raspberries, my raspberries, everybody's raspberries are going to send up their new shoots. These shoots will grow very long throughout the summer, and at the end of summer will produce a flush of raspberries right on the tips. With most varieties, the canes that are here from last year, the ones that fruited last fall, may appear to be dead because they're all browned out now, but they will wake up and they will send out green shoots up and down their entire length. And very early in the summer, late spring, early summer, these second-year canes produce a very large cluster of fruits. So large that I typically get 2 or 3 times as many raspberries in the late spring as I do in the fall. Now, after those second-year canes have fruited the second time, then they're done and they can be pruned out. I'm always afraid I'm going to make a mistake, so I just leave them alone. By the end of that second year, they get all brittle and they just snap off when you pull at them. So that's, you can't make a mistake that way.
Okay, so leave them be.
That's always the best answer in gardening. If you're not sure as to what to do, just leave them alone. The only plants that come to mind that absolutely demand pruning are fruit trees and maybe roses, because it's needed to improve the quality and help fight diseases. But with raspberries, which are a very wild plant, they, you know, as you can see, yours are already spreading. They're going to spread much more. Every year, you'll learn to fall more and more into the rhythm of the plant. You'll know to expect that crop in the fall. You'll know you're going to get a second crop from those same canes. And then, like I said, very quickly, that summer, those canes just turn into firewood, just turn brittle. So really, the truth is, if a cane still has some greenness, still has some suppleness to it, don't prune it, because you can only make a mistake.
All righty.
Okay?
Well, thank you so much. I love your show.
Well, thank you, and enjoy your raspberries.
I will. You too. Bye.
All right. As promised, it's time for the question of the week, protecting plants from the Colorado potato beetle. Our question this week comes from Rick in Louisa, Virginia. He writes, I have a family farm in central Virginia that has a major pest problem. For years, we've grown mostly potatoes for our family. However, we lose a large portion of the crop to the Colorado potato beetle. For years, we have used liquid and powdered 7 with okay results. But now I'd like to find a more healthy and natural way to fight the bugs. Can you offer any advice on what types of beneficial insects to use and where to buy them? or is there a chemical that's safe to use? We plant about 15 acres in potatoes, tomatoes, beans, apples, pears, squash, cucumbers, and peppers, and most things do well, even though we can't care for them every day, as we live over 2 hours away in Maryland. But the potatoes get torn to shreds by those beetles. Any information would be helpful? Thanks. Well, Rick, Colorado potato beetles are a notorious pest to potatoes. And they can cross over to chowing down on your tomatoes, peppers, and eggplant when conditions are right. Now, of course, your absentee status makes any form of pest control much more difficult. The most important tool of farming or gardening is always the daily inspection. Otherwise, you can't catch problems at an early stage. As you note in your email, the incredibly toxic and dangerous pesticide 7 is only okay at controlling these pests, and you are wise to move away from it. What's the point of growing food for your children on poisoned soil? Now, if you look through our A to Z archives, you saw Colorado potato beetles listed as prime candidates for control by toads. So installing a few ponds and big shady areas near your potato plantings would be a very good start. And toads eat a wide variety of farm and garden pests. I'd put some bird baths right in the middle of your potato patches as well to make a nice destination for potentially hungry avian avengers in the summertime. Although I generally don't recommend tilling because of the weed problems it can cause, deep cultivation in the fall and spring is a good idea here, at least until you get the problem under control, as the last generation of adults overwinters in the soil near where the previous potatoes grew. Unfortunately, they go pretty deep, so you got to till down low. Crop rotation would also be a really good idea. The adults don't have a lot of energy when they emerge from the soil, so make it a long walk for them to get to this year's plants. And if you do move your potatoes to another location, consider surrounding them with a trench lined with plastic. This old-fashioned beetle trap can be very effective. Because potatoes don't need pollination, row covers can provide excellent protection. These thin, spun polyester blankets are a staple of organic lettuce and spinach growing, allowing light, air, and rain through, but no insects. And pests can't eat plants they can't reach. Good quality row covers will last for years, and they'll improve the quality of your spuds, and they'll give you those super tasty young new potatoes much earlier in the season, thanks to the little bit of extra heat they trap underneath the covers. Now, another great way to deter these and many other pests indirectly is with a professionally made clay spray. The biggest brand name is Surround. A godsend for tree fruit growers, the micronized sprayable clay is 100% natural, and it doesn't interfere with photosynthesis, but it does provide a surprisingly effective barrier to pests and disease. And it's specifically recommended for Colorado potato beetle control. As are the beneficial insects you ask about. As any spud grower can tell you, the nastiest part of this pest is its extremely grotesque immature stage, a squishy, sticky, ugly, almost formless little leaf muncher. Think Slimer in the Ghostbusters movies. Ah, but this soft-bodied stage is much more vulnerable to attack than the armored, somewhat ladybug-like adult. Lots of beneficial insects like to eat or parasitize such soft-bodied prey, including real ladybugs, lacewings, and those amazing little mini-wasps. All are available commercially, and you can also attract local versions and get them all to breed and be happy in your garden by planting lots of small herbs around your potatoes and allowing them to flower to provide pollen and nectar for the insects, and by filling dishes with pebbles and water to provide safe areas for them to perch and drink without risk of drowning. Ground beetles also chow down on potato plant pests. Now, there is a specific spray-on control that's organic for Colorado potato beetles. It's a version of BT known as BT San Diego that affects only the juvenile form of the beetle. It works very well on those ugly babies, but it can be hard to find a source of this highly specialized pesticide. Note, this is not the form of BT that controls caterpillars. There are several types of BT. All of the BTs are specific, and the caterpillar kind, known as BT corstachii, will not harm beetle grubs, although it's an excellent caterpillar control. Probably the best choice for an all-around organic spray-on bug killer would be one of the spinosad products, which are available under a wide variety of brand names. The effects are concentrated on pests that eat the sprayed leaves, so avoid spraying any directly on the beneficial insects, and it should have little to no effect on your good bugs. Well, that sure was some good advice on how to beat the beetles, now wasn't it? Luckily, you can read the print version of the question of the week at your leisure, or even leisure, at the Gardens Alive website. Just click the link at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Yikes! My producer is threatening to subject me to ground beetle attack if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499 or send us your email, your tired, your poor, your wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org. Please tell us where you live. Please put the actual subject in the subject line. Oi, it's not that hard. And check first to see if the information you seek is already waiting for you at our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where you can click through to the question of the week. Find the solution to hundreds of garden problems. Hint, hint, take a hint. In our alphabetized archive of garden answers. Hint, hint. And or listen to this show, listen to old shows, and or download this week's podcast. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week is Kevin Love Train Griffin. Our webmasters are Rich Savage Server Banowitz and Sarah the She-Devil Kazar. Our intern, Jessica Mandick, is back and recovered. Welcome back, Jess. Back without recovery time is the hardest working woman in show business, Alexis Landis, who produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. Still lingering in the land of the lost is our esteemed editor, Al Banks. I'm in recovery, Mike McGrath, and I'll Charlie Sheen you next week. The flowering crepe myrtle is a real favorite down south, and it's moving further north every year. I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, we'll discuss crepe murder and other ill-advised pruning techniques, plus your fabulous phone calls.
Next Saturday at 11 o'clock on WHYY.